Chapter 2. March 4th, 12:44 p.m. Vladivostok, Russia.
You owe me a new windshield, Bogdan Fedosyev boomed, handing Tucker a shot glass of ice-cold vodka.
He accepted it, but placed the glass on the end table next to the couch. He was not fond of vodka, and more important, he didn't trust his hands right now. The aftermath of the shootout at the shipyard had left Tucker pumping with adrenaline, neither an unfamiliar nor unpleasant rush for him. Even so, he wondered how much of that rush was exhilaration, and how much was PTSD, a clinical acronym for what used to be called shell shock, or battle fatigue, a condition all too common for many Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. Compared to most, Tucker's case was mild, but it was a constant in his life. Though he managed it well, he could still feel it lurking there, like a monster probing for a chink in his mental armor. Tucker found the metaphor strangely reassuring. Vigilance was something he did well. Still, the Buddhist in him whispered in his ear to relax his guard. Let go of it. What you cling to only gets stronger. What you think, you become. Tucker couldn't quite nail down when and where he'd adopted this philosophy. It had snuck up on him. He'd had a few teachers, one in particular, but he suspected he'd picked up his worldview from his wanderings with Cain. Having encountered people of almost every stripe, Tucker had learned to take folks as they came, without the baggage of preconceptions. People were more alike than different. Everyone was just trying to find a way to be happy, to feel fulfilled. The manner in which they searched for that state differed wildly, but the prize remained the same. Enough, Tucker commanded himself. Contemplation was fine, but he'd long ago decided it was a lot like tequila, best taken only in small doses. At his feet, Cain sat at ease, but his eyes remained bright and watchful. The shepherd missed nothing. Posture, hand and eye movements, respiration rate, perspiration. All of it painted a clear picture for his partner. Unsurprisingly, Cain had picked up on the anxiety in the air. Tucker felt it too. One of the reasons he had been paired with Cain was his unusually high empathy scores. Military war dog handlers had a saying, "It runs down the lead," describing how emotions of the pair became shared over time, binding them together. The same skill allowed Cain to read people, to pick up nuances of body language and expression that others might miss. Like now, with the tension in the room.
"And the side mirror of the limo,"
Fedosyev added with a strained grin.
"You destroyed both windshield and mirror. Very costly. And worst of all, you could have killed Peter, my driver."
Tucker refused to back down, knowing it would be a sign of weakness.
"At that distance and angle, the rifle I used didn't have enough foot-pounds to penetrate the limo's ballistic glass. Maybe if I was standing on the hood of the car, Peter might have had something to worry about."
Stymied, Fedosyev frowned.
"Still, very expensive things to fix on limousine, yes?"
"You can take it out of my bonus," Tucker replied.
"Bonus? What bonus?"
"The one you're going to give me for saving your life."
Standing behind Fedosyev, Yuri said,
"We would have handled the..."
Fedosyev held up his hand, silencing his subordinate. Yuri's face flushed. Behind him, the pair of bodyguards at the door shifted their feet, glancing down. Tucker knew what Yuri and his security team were thinking. Would haves were worthless when it comes to personal protection. The fact was, this outsider, this American and his dog, had saved their boss. Still, Yuri had intervened on Tucker's behalf with the police, smoothing over the complications that could have risen over killing the first shooter. Russian bodyguards taking down a would-be assassin was a simple matter. A former U.S. Army Ranger, not so much. 90 minutes after apprehending the second man, who was now in police custody, Tucker met Fedosyev and his entourage back at the Meridian Hotel, where the Russian had rented the top floor of VIP suites. The decor and furnishings were comfortable, but overly ornate. Shabby Soviet chic. Outside, snow still fell, obscuring what would have been a stunning view of Peter the Great Bay and mainland Russia.
"I do you better than bonus," Fedosyev offered. "You become part of my team. Permanent part. I am generous. Your dog will eat steak every night. He would like that, yes?"
"Ask him yourself."
Fedosyev's gaze flickered toward Kane. Then he smiled and wagged his finger at Tucker.
"Very funny."
He tried a different angle.
"You know, these two Suka may have had a helper. If he is still around."
Suka was one of Fedosyev's favorite slang terms. Roughly and politely, a suka meant scumbag. Tucker interrupted.
"If you're right, I'm sure Yuri will find anyone else involved in this attempted assassination."
Especially with one of the attackers already in custody. Up here, torture was as common a tool as a knife and fork.
Fedosyev sighed.
"Then your answer is..."
"I appreciate the offer," he said, "but my contract's up in 2 days. Past that, I've got somewhere to be."
It was a lie, but no one called him on it. The truth was, he had nowhere to be, and right now, he liked it that way. Plus, Yuri and his team were all ex-military, and that background infused everything they did and said. He'd had his fill of them. Tucker had done his time in the military, and the parting had been less than amicable. Of course, he'd loved his early days in the army and had been contemplating going career. Until Anaconda. He reached for the abandoned glass of vodka as the unwanted memory of the past swept over him. He hated how the cubes rattled against the crystal as he lifted the tumbler. PTSD. He considered it merely a piece of psychic shrapnel lodged near his heart. He sipped at the liquor, letting the memory wash through him. Not that he had any choice. Tucker again felt the pop of his ears as the rescue helicopter lifted off, felt the rush of hot air. He closed his eyes, remembering that day, drawn back to that firefight. He had been assisting soldiers from the 10th Mountain Division secure a series of bunkers in Hell's Halfpipe. He had been flanked by two partners that day, Kane and Kane's littermate, Abel. If Kane had been Tucker's right arm, Abel was his left. He'd trained them both. Then a distress call had reached his team in the mountains. A Chinook helicopter carrying a team of Navy SEALs had been downed by RPG fire on a peak called Takur Gar. Tucker and his squad were dispatched east and had begun the arduous climb to Takur Gar when they were ambushed in a ravine. A pair of IEDs exploded, killing most of Tucker's squad and wounding the rest, including Abel, whose left front leg had been blown off at the elbow. Within seconds, Taliban fighters emerged from concealed positions and swarmed the survivors. Tucker, along with a handful of soldiers, was able to reach a defensible position and hold out long enough for an evac helicopter to land. Once Kane and his teammates were loaded, he was about to jump off and return for Abel, but before he could do so, a crewman dragged him back aboard and held him down, where he could only watch. As the helo lifted off and banked over the ravine, a pair of Taliban fighters chased down Abel, who was limping toward the rising helo, his pained eyes fixed on Tucker, his severed leg trailing blood. Tucker scrambled for the door, only to be pulled back yet again. Then the Taliban fighters reached Abel. He squeezed those last memories away, but not the haunting voice forever in the back of his mind. You could have tried harder. You could have reached him. If he had, he knew he would have been killed too, but at least Abel wouldn't have been alone. Alone, and wondering why Tucker had abandoned him. Back in his own skin, he opened his eyes and downed the rest of the vodka in a single gulp, letting the burn erase the worst of that old pain.
Mr. Wayne!
Bogdan Fedosyev leaned forward, his forehead creased with concern.
Are you ill? You've gone dead pale, my friend.
Tucker cleared his throat, shook his head. Without looking, he knew Kane was staring at him. He reached out and gave the shepherd's neck a reassuring squeeze.
I'm fine. What were we talking?
Fedosyev leaned back.
You and your dog joining us.
Tucker focused his eyes on Fedosyev and on the present.
No. As I said, I'm sorry. I've got somewhere to be.
Though it was a lie, he was ready to move on, needed to move on. But the question remained, what would he do?
Fedosyev sighed loudly. Very well, but if you change your mind, you tell me. Tonight you stay in one of the suites. I send up two steaks, one for you, one for your dog.
Tucker nodded, stood, and shook Fedosyev's hand. For now, that was enough of a plan. 11:56 p.m. The chirp of his satellite phone instantly woke Tucker in his room. He scrambled for it while checking the clock. Almost midnight. What now? With nothing on Fedosyev's schedule for that evening, Tucker and Kane had been given the night off. Had something happened? Yuri had already informed him earlier that the Vladikavkaz separatist taken into custody had broken and talked, spilling everything. So Tucker had expected a quiet night. He checked the incoming number as he picked up the phone. A block number. That was seldom good. Kane sat at the edge of the bed, watching Tucker. He lifted the phone and pressed the talk button.
Hello.
A series of squeaks and buzzes suggested the call was being filtered through a series of digital coders. Finally, the caller spoke.
Captain Wayne, I'm glad I could reach you.
Tucker relaxed, but not completely. Suspicion rang through him as he recognized the voice. It was Painter Crow, the director of Sigma Force, and the man who'd tried to recruit Tucker not so long after a prior mission. The full extent of Sigma's involvement in the U.S. intelligence and defense community was still a mystery to him, but one thing he did know. Sigma worked under the aegis of the ultra-secretive DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Tucker cleared the rasp of sleep from his voice.
I assume you know what time it is here, Director.
I do. My apologies. It's important.
Isn't it always? What's going on?
I believe your contract with Bogdan Fedosyev is almost up. In 2 more days, if I'm not mistaken.
Tucker should have been surprised that the caller had this information, but this was Painter Crow, who had resources that bordered on the frightening.
Director, I'm guessing this isn't a casual call, so why don't you get to your point?
I need a favor. And you've got 42 days still left on your Russian visa.
And something tells me you want those days.
Only a few. We've got a friend I'd like you to meet.
I've got enough friends. Why is this one so special?
There was a pause, one that took too long. He understood. While the call was encrypted, Tucker's room could have been bugged. Probably was bugged, knowing the Russians. Any further details would require additional precautions. He couldn't say such subterfuge didn't intrigue him. He also suspected this lapse in the conversation was a test. Tucker proved his understanding of the need for privacy by asking another question.
Where?
1/2 mile from your hotel. A payphone on the northeast corner of the Grey Horse Apartments.
I'll find it. Give me 20 minutes.
He was there in 18, stamping his feet against the cold. Using a prepaid calling card, Tucker dialed Sigma's cover trunk line, then waded through another series of encoder tones before Crow's voice came on the line. The director got straight to the point.
I need you to escort a man out of the country.
The simple sentence was fraught with layers of information. The fact that Crow didn't think their friend was capable of accomplishing this feat on his own already told Tucker two things. One, the man was of high value to Sigma. Two, normal travel options were problematic. In other words, someone didn't want the man leaving the country. Tucker knew better than to ask why this target needed to leave Russia. Crow was a firm believer in the need-to-know policy, but Tucker had another question that he wanted answered.
Why me?
You're already in country, have an established cover, and your skill set matches the job.
And you have no other assets available.
That too. But it's a secondary consideration.
Just so we're clear, Director, this is a favor. Nothing more. If you're trying to court me to join...
Not at all. Get our friend out of the country and you're done. You'll make twice your usual retainer. For this mission, I'm assigning you an operations handler. Her name is Ruth Harper.
Not you?
This surprised him, and he didn't like surprises.
Director, you know I don't play well with others, especially those I've never met face to face.
Harper is good, Tucker. Really knows her stuff. Give her a chance.
So, will you do it?
Tucker sighed. While he had little trust in government agencies, Crow had so far proven himself to be a stand-up guy.
Give me the details.
Chapter 3. March 7th, 8:07 a.m. Siberia, Russia. The door to Tucker's private berth on the train slid back, and a head bearing a blue cap peeked through.
Papers, please,
the train porter ordered, tempering his KGB-like request with a friendly smile. The sliver-thin young man could be no more than 20, his coal-black hair peeking from under his crisp hat. He kept the buttons of his uniform well-polished, clearly very proud of his job. Tucker handed over his passport. The porter studied it, nodded, and handed it back. The man's eyes settled nervously on Kane. The shepherd sat upright in the seat opposite Tucker, panting, tongue hanging.
And your animal?
The porter asked.
Service animal.
Tucker handed over Kane's packet, courtesy of Painter Crow. The papers certified his furry companion was a working dog, adept at sensing Tucker's frequent and debilitating epileptic seizures. It was a ruse, of course, but traveling with a 70-pound military war dog tended to raise unwanted questions. The porter reviewed the papers and nodded.
Da, I see. My second cousin suffers the same sickness.
His gaze returned to Kane, but with more affection and sympathy now.
May I pet him?
Tucker shrugged.
Sure. He doesn't bite.
Not unless I tell him to. Tentatively, the porter reached out and scratched Kane under the chin.
Good doggy.
Kane regarded him impassively, tolerating the familiarity. Tucker resisted the urge to smile. Satisfied, the porter grinned and returned the documents to Tucker.
I like him very much,
the young man said.
I do, too.
If there's anything you need, you ask, da?
Tucker nodded as the porter exited and slid the door closed. He settled back, staring at the Russian scenery passing by the window, which mostly consisted of snowy trees and Soviet bloc-era buildings as the train headed out of Vladivostok. The port city marked one end of this route of the Trans-Siberian Railway, the other was Moscow. Not that he and Kane were traveling that far. For reasons Crow hadn't explained, Tucker's target wouldn't be ready for extraction for a week, so after completing his final 2 days with Bogdan Fedosyev, Tucker had boarded the famous Trans-Siberian Railway and settled in for the 5-day journey to the city of Perm. Once there, he was to meet a contact who would take him to his target, a man named Abram Bukulov. Tucker still had no idea why the man needed to leave Russia in such a clandestine manner, especially such a high-profile figure. Tucker had recognized his name as soon as Crow had mentioned it on the phone. Tucker's previous employer, Bogdan Fedosyev, had had business dealings with this man in the past. Abram Bukulov was the owner of Horizon Industries and arguably the country's pharmacological tycoon. A frequent face on magazine covers and television shows, Bukulov was to prescription drugs what Steve Jobs had been to personal computing. In the years following the breakup of the Soviet Union, the pharmaceutical industry in Russia disintegrated into disarray and corruption, from the quality of the drugs themselves to the distribution networks. Thousands were thought to have died from tainted drugs or faulty doses. Through sheer force of will and inherited wealth, Abram Bukulov slowly and steadily bent the system to his benevolent will, becoming the keeper of Russia's pharmacy. And now he wanted out, all but abandoning a multi-billion-dollar empire he had spent his entire adult life building. Why? And what could possibly drive such a man to run so scared? According to the encrypted dossier sent by Painter Crow, the only clue lay in Bukulov's mysterious warning. The Arzamas 16 generals are after me. The man refused to explain more until he was safely out of Russia. Tucker had studied the rest of the files for this mission over and over again. Bukulov was a well-known eccentric, a personality trait that shone in every interview of him. He was clearly a driven visionary with a zealous passion to match. But had he finally snapped? And what about these Arzamas 16 generals? From the research notes included in the dossier, there was once a city named Arzamas 16. During the rule of Joseph Stalin, it was home to the Soviet Union's first nuclear weapons design center. The U.S. intelligence community simply referred to it as the Russian Los Alamos. But it was only the first of the many Naukagrads, or closed science cities, that popped up across the Soviet Union, secured by iron-clad perimeters. In such places, top-secret projects under the aegis of the best Soviet scientists were conducted. Rumors abounded during the Cold War of biological weapons, mind-control drugs, and stealth technology. But Arzamas 16 no longer existed. In its place, the region had become home to a couple of nuclear weapons test facilities. But what did anything like that have to do with Abram Bukulov? And who could these nefarious generals be? It made no sense. He glanced over at Kane, who wagged his tail, ready for whatever was to come. Tucker settled back, deciding that was probably the best course of action from here. Just be ready for anything. Chapter 4. March 7th, 10:42 a.m. Moscow, Russia. The large man stepped around his desk and settled into his chair with a creak of leather. He had the call up on his speakerphone. He had no fear of anyone listening. No one dared, especially not here.
"Where is the target now?"
he asked. Word had reached his offices that an operative, an American mercenary with a dog, had been assigned to help Dr. Bukulov leave Russian soil. That must not happen.
"Heading west," the caller answered in Swedish-accented Russian. "Aboard the Trans-Siberian. We know he's booked through to Perm, but whether that's his final destination, we don't know yet."
"What makes you think it would be otherwise?"
"This one clearly has some training. My instincts tell me he wouldn't book a ticket straight to his ultimate destination. He's too clever for that."
"What name is he traveling under?"
"We're working on that too," the Swede answered, growing testy.
"And where are you now?"
driving to Khabarovsk. We tried to board the train at Vladivostok, but...
He gave you the shake, da?
Yes. Let me understand this. A man and a large dog lost you and your team. Did he see you? No. Of that we're certain. He is simply careful and well-trained. What else have you learned about him?
Nothing much. I'm making inquiries trying to track his finances, but it appears he is using a credit card that has been backstopped, sanitized. It suggests he's either more than he seems to be or has powerful help, or both. What came of the hotel search in Vladivostok?
Nothing. We couldn't get close. His employer, that bastard Bogdan Fedosyev, rented out the entire penthouse. Security was too tight. But if we can reach Khabarovsk before the train does, we'll board there.
If not... The Swede's words trailed off. Neither of them had to verbalize the problems such a failure would present. The railway branched frequently from there, with routes heading in many different directions, including into China and Mongolia. Following their target into a foreign country, especially China, would exponentially multiply their surveillance challenges. The speakerphone crackled again as the caller offered one hope.
If he is using sanitized credit cards, we should assume he has several passports and travel documents. If you have any colleagues in the FPS, it may be helpful to circulate his photo.
He nodded to himself, rubbing his chin. The caller was referring to Russia's Federal Border Guard Service.
As you said, the caller continued, a man and a large dog are hard to miss.
I'll see what I can do. I would prefer to keep the scope of this operation limited. That's why I hired you. Sadly, I'm beginning to question my judgment. Get results, or I'll be making a change. Do you understand my meaning?
A long silence followed before a response came.
Not to worry. I've never failed before. I'll get the information you need, and he'll be dead before he ever reaches Perm.
Chapter 5. March 7th. 6:08 p.m. Trans-Siberian Railway. A voice over the intercom system called out first in Russian, then in English.
Next stop, Khabarovsk!
A scrolling green LED sign on the wall of Tucker's berth repeated the multilingual message along with, departing again in 18 minutes. Tucker began gathering his things, tugging on his coat. Once done, he patted Kane.
What do you say we stretch our legs?
They'd been cooped up in the car for most of the day, and he knew he could use a bit of fresh air. He pulled on his fur trapper's cap, attached Kane's lead, then opened the berth door. He followed the slow trudge of fellow passengers down the corridor to the exit steps. A few eyebrows were raised at the sight of his unusual traveling companion. One matronly babushka gave him what he could best describe as the evil eye. Taking heed of the unnecessary attention, he avoided the terminal building, a whitewashed, green-tiled, Kremlin-esque structure, and guided Kane across the train tracks to a patch of scrub brush. A chest-high fence, missing more pickets than it retained, bordered the area. As Kane sniffed and marked his territory, Tucker stretched his back and legs. Aboard the train, he had caught up on his sleep, and he had the muscle kinks to prove it. After a few minutes, the screech of tires drew his attention past the terminal. The frantic blare of a car horn followed. He spotted a line of cars stopped at the intersection as a departing eastbound train cleared the station. As the caboose clunked over the road and the barriers rose, a black sedan swerved to the head of the line and raced into the terminal parking lot. He checked his watch. 4 minutes to departure. Whoever was in the sedan was cutting it close. He let Kane wander for another full minute, then walked back over the tracks to their train car. Once returned to their berth, Kane jumped into his usual seat, panting, refreshed. A commotion out on the terminal platform drew his attention, too. A trio of men in long black leather dusters strode purposefully along the length of the train, occasionally stopping porters and showing them what looked to be a photo before moving on again. None of the men offered any credentials. Faint alarm bells sounded in Tucker's head. But there were hundreds of people on the train, he told himself, and so far all the porters had merely shrugged or shook their heads when shown the photo. Clearly frustrated, one of the men pulled out a cell phone and spoke into it. 30 seconds later, he was joined by his partners, and after a brief discussion, the trio hurried back into the terminal and disappeared from view. He watched and waited, but none of them reappeared. He sighed in relief when the train whistle blew and the all aboard was called. The train lurched forward and slowly pulled away from the station. Only then did he settle back in his own seat. But he was hardly settled. 7:38 p.m. An hour later, too full of nervous energy to remain inside the berth, Tucker found himself seated in the dining car. Around him, the tables were draped with linen, the windows framed by silk curtains, the place settings china and crystal. But his attention focused on the car's best feature. While he had never been the type to ogle the opposite sex, the woman sitting across the aisle and one booth down was challenging his discipline. She was tall and lithe, her figure accentuated by a form-fitting skirt and a white cashmere turtleneck sweater. She wore her blonde hair long and straight, framing high cheekbones and ice-blue eyes. Picking at a salad and occasionally sipping from a glass of wine, she spent most of the meal either reading a dog-eared copy of Anna Karenina or staring out the window as dusk settled over the Siberian landscape. For one chance moment, she looked up, caught Tucker's eye, and smiled. Genuine, pleasant, but clearly reserved. Still, her body language was easy to read. "Thank you, but I'd prefer to be alone." A few minutes later, the woman signaled for the check, signed her bill, then swished past Tucker's table and through the connecting door to the berth cars. Tucker lingered over his coffee, oddly disappointed, more than he should be, then headed back to his own berth. As he stepped into the corridor, he found the blonde woman kneeling on the floor, the contents of her purse scattered at her feet, some of it rolling farther away with each jostle of the train's wheels. Tucker walked over and dropped to a knee beside her.
"Let me help."
She frowned, tucked a strand of blonde hair behind her ear, and offered him a shy smile.
"Thank you. Everything seems to be getting away from me lately."
Her accent was British, refined. Tucker helped her gather the runaway items, then stood up. He nodded at her copy of Anna Karenina.
"The butler did it, by the way."
She blinked at him, momentarily confused. Tucker added,
"In the library, with a lead pipe."
She smiled.
"Well, goodness. Then there's not much point in my finishing it, is there?"
"Sorry if I ruined it for you."
"You've read it?"
"In high school," he said.
"And your verdict?"
"Certainly not beach reading. I liked it, but not enough to wade through it a second time."
"It's my third time. I'm a glutton for punishment, I suppose."
She extended her hand.
"Well, thank you again."
He took her hand, finding her fingers soft but firm.
"Tucker," he said.
"I'm Felice. Thank you for your help. I hope you have a pleasant night."
It had certainly turned out pleasant.
She turned and started down the corridor. 10 feet away, she stopped and spoke without turning.
"It doesn't seem quite fair, you know."
Tucker didn't reply, but waited until she turned to face him before asking,
"What isn't?"
"You spoiling the end of a perfectly good Russian novel."
"I see your point. I take it that an apology isn't enough."
"Not even close."
breakfast, then? Her lips pursed as Felice considered this a moment.
Is 7 too early for you?
He smiled. See you in the morning. With a slight wave, she turned and headed down the corridor. He watched until she vanished out of sight, enjoying every step she took. Once alone, he opened the door to his berth and found Kane sitting on the floor staring up at him. The shepherd must have heard his voice out in the passageway. Kane tilted his head in his customary, "What's going on?" fashion. He smiled and scratched Kane between the ears.
"Sorry, pal. She didn't have a friend."
Chapter 6. March 8th, 6:55 a.m., Trans-Siberian Railway. The next morning, Tucker arrived 5 minutes early to find Felice already seated at a booth in the rear of the dining car. For the moment, they had the space to themselves. This time of the year, the sun was still not up, just a rosy promise to the east. Tucker walked over and sat down.
"You're a morning person, I see."
"Since I was a little girl, I'm afraid. It drove my parents quite mad. By the way, I ordered coffee for 2, if you don't mind. I'm a much better morning person with caffeine in my system."
"That makes 2 of us."
The waiter arrived with a pair of steaming mugs and took their orders. Felice opted for the closest semblance to a standard big English breakfast. He nodded his approval, appreciating a woman with a good appetite. In turn, he chose an omelet with toasted black bread.
"You're the owner of that large hound, aren't you?" Felice asked. "The one that looks smarter than most people on this train."
"Owner isn't the word I would use, but yes."
He offered up his service dog story, explaining about his epilepsy.
"I don't know what I'd do without him."
At least that last part was true.
"Where are you two headed?"
she asked.
"I'm booked to Perm, but I'm flexible. Plenty to explore out here. We might get off and sightsee if the mood strikes us. And you?"
She gave him a sly smile.
"Is that an invitation?"
He gave her a shrug that was noncommittal with a hint of invitation, which only widened her smile. She skirted over to tamer topics.
"As to me, I'm headed to Moscow, off to meet some friends from my university days."
"You went to school there?"
"Goodness, no. Cambridge, Arts and Humanities. Hinc lusum et pocula sacra, and all that. From here, light and sacred draughts. Latin motto. Very highbrow, you see. 2 of my girlfriends moved to Moscow last year. We're having a small reunion."
"You boarded in Khabarovsk?"
"Yes, and almost got run over in the parking lot for my trouble. A big black car."
"I remember hearing some honking, saw some commotion. Was that them?"
She nodded.
3 men, dressed like old-school KGB thugs. Quite gloomy-looking. Very rude. Marching around the platform like they owned the place. Flashing their badges."
Tucker struggled to keep his brow from furrowing.
"Sounds like the police. Perhaps they were looking for someone."
She took a dismissive sip of coffee.
"I can only imagine."
"It's not you, is it? I'm not having breakfast with an international art thief."
She laughed, tilting her head back and slightly to the side.
"Oh, my cover has been blown. Stop the train at once."
He smiled.
"According to my guide, Khabarovsk's Fedotov Gallery is a must-see for art connoisseurs. Especially for any sightseeing arts and humanities graduates from Cambridge. I almost wish I had gotten off the train to go. Did you visit?"
She nodded, her eyes shining. "Absolutely stunning. Wish I'd had more time myself. You must go back sometime. And you, Mr. Wayne, what's your secret? What do you do when you're not traipsing around Siberia?"
"International art thief," he replied.
"Ah, I thought as much."
He patted his jacket pocket.
"Excuse me," he said,
and pulled out his phone, glancing at the screen.
"Text from my brother."
He opened the phone's camera application and surreptitiously snapped a shot of Felice's face. He studied the screen for a few more seconds, pretended to type a response, then returned the phone to his pocket. "Sorry," he said. "My brother's getting married in a month, and he's put me in charge of his bachelor party. His wife is worried it's going to be too risque."
Felice raised an eyebrow. "And is it?"
"Absolutely."
"Men," she said, laughing,
and reached across the table and gave his forearm a squeeze.
8:35 a.m. After finishing breakfast and lingering over coffee for another half hour, the two parted company with a promise to share another meal before Tucker disembarked at Perm. Once free, he returned quickly to his berth, pulled out his satellite phone, and speed-dialed the new number Painter Crow had given him. It was answered immediately.
"Tucker Wayne, I presume?"
a female voice answered.
"Ruth Harper."
"Correct."
Harper's speech was clipped, precise, but somehow not quite curt. There was also a distinct southern accent there, too.
"What do you have for me?"
Harper asked.
"No, nice to meet you, or how are you?"
"Nice to meet you. How are you? How's that? Warm and fuzzy enough for you?"
"Marginally," Tucker replied.
As he paced the small space, he tried to picture what she looked like. She sounded young, but with a bite at the edges that spoke of some toughness. Maybe late 30s. But he knew Sigma operatives had prior military experience, and Harper was likely no exception. So some of that toughness could be from hard lessons learned young and early maturity gained under fire. From her seriousness, he imagined her dark-haired, wearing glasses, a battle-weary librarian. He smiled inwardly at that image.
"So, what's your take on the situation?"
she asked.
"I think I've picked up a tail."
"Why do you think that, Captain Wayne?"
Her tone grew grave, with a trace of doubt.
"Just call me Tucker," he said,
and explained about the leather-jacketed men on the Khabarovsk train platform, and Felice's insistence they were flashing badges.
"And they weren't?" Harper asked.
"No. They were just showing a photograph, I'm sure of it. She also claims she visited the Fedotev Gallery in Khabarovsk. It's been closed for renovations for the past month."
"And you know this detail how?"
"There's not much else to do on this train but sleep and read travel brochures."
"Anything else that makes you suspicious of her?"
"She's pretty, and she finds me fascinating."
"That certainly is odd. Are you sure she's in possession of her faculties?"
He smiled at her matter-of-fact tone.
"Funny."
He decided he might like Ruth Harper.
"Your accent," Tucker said. "Tennessee?"
She ignored his attempt to draw her out. But from the exasperated tone of her next words, he guessed he was wrong about Tennessee.
"Give me Felice's pedigree," she said, staying professional.
Tucker passed on the information he had gleaned, her name, her background at the University of Cambridge, her friends in Moscow.
"And I have a picture. I assume your wizards have access to facial recognition programs."
"Indeed we do."
"I'm sending it now."
"Okay. Sit tight, and I'll get back to you."
It didn't take long. Harper called back within 40 minutes.
"Your instinct was sound," she said without preamble. "But you've picked up more than a tail. She's a freelance mercenary."
"I knew it was too good to be true," he muttered. "Let's hear it."
"Her real name is Felice Nilsson, but she's traveling under Felice Johansson, Swedish citizenship. She's 33, born in Stockholm to a wealthy family. She didn't graduate from Cambridge, but from University of Gothenburg, with a master's in fine arts and music. And here's where things get interesting. 6 months after graduating, she joined the Swedish Armed Forces, and eventually ended up in Sahwilda in Hantingsgruppen."
"Sig?"
As a member of the U.S. Special Forces, Tucker had to know the competition, both allied and enemy alike.
SIG was the Swedish Special Reconnaissance Group. Its operatives were trained in intelligence gathering, reconnaissance, and covert surveillance, along with being superb, hardened soldiers. She was one of the group's first female members, Harper added. What was her specialty?
Sniper.
Great.
I urge you to approach her with extreme caution.
Caution? Never would have thought of that.
Harper let out what could be taken as a soft chuckle, but it disappeared so quickly that Tucker couldn't be sure.
Point taken, she said. But do not underestimate her. After 6 years in the SIG, Nilsson resigned her commission. 8 months later, she started popping up on intel radars, first working small-time stuff as a mercenary, mostly for established groups. Then, 2 years ago, she struck out on her own, forming her own team, all former Swedish Special Forces. Last estimate put her roster at 6 to 8, including herself.
Bored rich girl goes rogue, Tucker said.
Maybe that's how it started, but she's got a real taste for it now, and a solid reputation. For now, the question remains, who hired her, and why?
You're in a better position to answer that than I am. But this must have something to do with your operation. Otherwise, it would be about me personally, and that doesn't seem likely.
Agreed.
And if that's true, if they're already on my tail, I don't have to tell you what that means.
We've got a leak, Harper replied.
Word of your involvement must have reached those who are hunting for Dr. Bukalov.
But who leaked that information? For the moment, let's assume it didn't come from anyone inside Sigma Command. So, who in Russia had my itinerary? Who knew I'd be aboard this train?
The only person with that information was the contact you're supposed to meet in Perm.
Who's that?
She didn't answer immediately, and Tucker knew why. If Felice Nilsson got her hands on Tucker, the less he knew, the less he could divulge.
Forget I asked, he said. So, the leak is either my contact or someone he told.
Most likely, she agreed.
Either way, it has to be Abram Bukalov thereafter. But the fact that Ms. Nilsson is on that train rather than out at Perm pursuing our contact, that tells us something.
And tells us whoever is paying her wants this to play out for some reason. This isn't all about Bukalov himself. Maybe it's something he has.
Something he knows. Again, I agree.
And trust me when I tell you this, I don't know what that could be. When he contacted us, he was tight-lipped. He told us only enough to make sure we'd get him out.
A moment of contemplative silence stretched. Then she asked,
"What's your plan? How do you want to play this?"
"Don't know yet. Assuming those leather jackets I saw at Khabarovsk were hers, they were in a hurry, and I think I know why. The next stop on this route is at the city of Chita, a major hub, where trains spread out in every direction. They had to tag me in Khabarovsk or risk losing me."
"Do you think her men got aboard?"
"I don't think so, but I'll have a look around." "I wonder if part of their job was a distraction, a spectacle to let Felice slip aboard without a fuss."
"Either way, you can bet she's in contact with them. You said there were no other stops before Chita?"
"Afraid not." Tucker checked his watch. "We'll arrive in 2.5 days. I'm going to check the route map. If the train slows below 30 miles per hour and the terrain is accommodating, we can roll off. It's the surest way to shake Felice off my trail."
"You're getting into the mountains out there, Tucker. Take care you don't tumble off a cliff."
"Glad to know you care, Harper.
Just worried about the dog."
He smiled, warming up to this woman. His image of the battle-weary librarian was developing some softer edges, including a glint of dark amusement in her eyes.
"As to Felice Nilsson," she continued, "don't kill her unless you have to."
"No promises, Harper, but I'll keep you posted." He disconnected and looked down at Kane, who was upright in his seat by the window.
How does a little backcountry romp sound to you, my friend?
Kane tilted his head and wagged his tail.
So it's unanimous.
As the train continued chugging west toward Cheetah, Tucker spent the remainder of the day strolling the train, twice bumping into Felice. They chatted briefly. Both times she deftly probed him about his plans. Would he be heading directly on to Perm? What would he do when he got there? Which hotel had he booked? He deflected his way through her questioning with lies and vague responses. Then he spent the rest of the afternoon seeking an easy place to jump from the train. Unlike Hollywood portrayals, one could not simply open a window or slip out between cars. While in motion, all the train's exits were locked, either directly or behind secure doors. Such security left Tucker with two choices. Either he remained aboard and attempted to shake loose of Felice at the Cheetah station, where she likely already had accomplices lying in wait, or he discovered a way to get through those locked exits and leap blindly from the train in the dead of night. Not great choices. Still, in the end, he had little trouble making the decision, leaning upon his military training and mindset. He came down to a simple adage drilled into him as an Army Ranger. Act. Don't react. Chapter 7. March 8th, 11:03 p.m. Trans-Siberian Railway. With the night darkening the berth's windows, Tucker made his final preparations. He had spent the last few hours of daylight walking through his plan, both mentally and physically, rehearsing his movements, along with timing and tracing the routines of the staff. After one final task, a bit of breaking and entering, he called Ruth Harper.
Did you get the photos I took of Felice's papers?
Earlier in the day, he had snuck into her berth while she was out. He rifled carefully through her bags and compartments, discovering four passports, her credit cards, and a Swedish driver's license. He took photos of them all with his cell phone, left the room as tidy as he had entered it, and sent them to Sigma Command. He wanted to know all he could about his opponent.
Yes, we got the pictures and are running them through our databases.
Hopefully by the time you finish that, whatever you find will be irrelevant.
Because he didn't plan to still be on the train by then.
In 40 minutes, the train will have to slow down for a hairpin turn along the river outside Bianchino.
Which is where exactly in the vast expanse that is Siberia?
About 300 miles east of Cheetah. A lot of small villages lie nearby and even more forest. That means lots of territory to lose ourselves in.
I assume you don't mean that literally. The downside of such isolation is that you're going to have trouble finding transportation to Perm, at least low-visibility transport.
I think I've got an idea about that.
You know the saying, no plan survives first contact with the enemy.
Tucker pictured Felice's face.
We've already made contact with the enemy, so it's time to get proactive.
Your call. You're on the scene. Good luck with...
From the door to his berth came a light knocking.
I've got company, he said. I'll call when I can. In the meantime, nothing to our friend in Perm. Agreed?
He didn't want his new itinerary, improvised as it was, leaked out to the wrong ears.
Understood, Harper acknowledged.
He disconnected, walked to the door, and slid it open. Felice leaned against the frame.
I trust it's not past your bedtime?
The expression on her face was one of coy invitation. Not too much, but just enough. Well practiced, he guessed.
I was just reading Kane a bedtime story.
I had hoped you'd join me for a late-night snack.
Tucker checked his watch.
The dining car is closed.
Felice smiled.
I have a secret cache in my berth.
we could debate the literary merits of Anna Karenina.
When Tucker didn't immediately reply, Felice let a little sparkle into her eye and turned up the corners of her mouth ever so slightly. She was very good, doing her best to keep her quarry close.
Okay, he said. Give me 10 minutes. Your berth is...
Next car up, second on the left.
He closed the door, then turned to Kane.
Plans have changed, pal. We're going now.
Kane jumped off his seat. From beneath it, Tucker pulled free the shepherd's tactical vest and secured it in place. Next, he opened his wardrobe, hauled out his already prepped rucksack, and shoved his cold weather gear, jacket, gloves, cap, into the top compartment. Once ready, Tucker slowly slid open his berth door and peeked out. To the right, the direction of Felice's berth, the corridor was clear. To the left, an elderly couple stood at the window, staring out at the night. With Kane at his heels, Tucker stepped out, slid the door shut behind him, and strode past the couple with a polite nod. He pushed through the glass connector door, crossed the small alcove between the two carriages, and pushed into the next sleeper car. The corridor ahead was thankfully empty. Halfway down, he stopped and cocked his head. Kane was looking back in the direction they'd come. Somewhere, a door had opened, then banged shut. Come on, Tucker said, and kept walking. He crossed through the next sleeper car and reached a glass door at the end. Beyond it, he spotted the small alcove that connected this carriage with the baggage coach. As he touched the door handle, a voice rose behind him from the far end of the corridor.
Tucker?
He recognized her voice, but didn't turn. He slid open the door.
Tucker, where are you going? I thought we were...
He stepped into the alcove with Kane and slid the glass door closed behind him. The shepherd immediately let out a low growl. Danger. Tucker swung around and locked eyes with a porter sharing the same cramped space, standing in the shadows off to the side. He immediately recognized the man's hard face, along with his deadly expression. It was one of Felice's team. The man had exchanged his black leather duster for a porter's outfit. Equally caught by surprise, the man lunged for his jacket pocket. Tucker didn't hesitate, kicking out with his heel, striking the man in the solar plexus. He fell back into the bulkhead, hitting his skull with a crack and slumping to the floor, knocked out. He reached into the man's pocket and pulled out a Walther P-22 semi-automatic. The magazine was full, one round in the chamber, the safety off. He re-engaged the safety and shoved the P-22 into his own belt, then rummaged through the man's clothes until he found a key ring and an identification badge. The picture it bore didn't match the slack face before him, but Tucker recognized the photo. It was the porter who had shyly petted Kane when they had first boarded. With a pang of regret, he knew the man was likely dead. Felice and company were playing hardball. Tucker took the keys, spun, and locked the connector door just as Felice reached it.
"What are you doing?"
she asked, feigning concern, a hand at her throat.
"Did you hurt that poor man?"
"He'll be fine. But what about the real porter?"
Doubt flickered in Felice's eyes.
"You're talking crazy. Just come out and we can..."
"Your English accent is slipping, Ms. Nielsen."
Felice's face changed like a passing shadow, going colder, more angular.
"So, what's your plan then, Mr. Wayne?"
she asked.
"Jump from the train and go where?" "Siberia is hell. You won't last a day."
"We love a challenge."
"You won't make it. We'll hunt you down. Work with me instead. The two of us together, we can..."
"Stop talking," he growled.
Felice shut her mouth, but her eyes were sharp with hatred. Tucker stepped away from the door and unlocked the baggage car. He pointed inside and touched Kane's side.
"Scent. Blood. Return."
His partner trotted into the darkened space. After 10 seconds, Kane let out an alert whine. He reappeared at Tucker's side and sat down, staring back into the baggage car. Tucker now knew the true fate of the unfortunate porter.
"We're leaving," he said to Felice. "If you're lucky, no one will find the body before you reach Chita."
"Who's to say you didn't kill him?" Felice said. "He caught you burglarizing the baggage car. You killed him, then jumped from the train. I'm a witness."
"If you want to draw that kind of attention to yourself, be my guest."
Tucker turned, stepped over the limp body of her partner, and entered the baggage car, closing the door behind him. Kane led him to the porter's body. The man had been shoved under a seat of steel bulkhead shelves. Judging from the bruising, he had been strangled to death.
"I'm sorry," Tucker murmured. He donned his jacket, gloves, and cap, then slung his rucksack over his shoulder. At the rear of the car, he used the porter's keys to unlock the metal door. It swung open, and a rush of wind shoved him sideways. The rattling of the train's wheels filled his ears. Directly ahead was the caboose door. With Kane following closely, Tucker stepped onto the open platform, shut the door behind him, then unlocked the caboose and stepped into the last car. He hurried across to the rear, through the last door, and a moment later they were at the tail end of the Trans-Siberian Express, standing on a railed catwalk. Beneath them, tracks flashed past. The sky was clear and black and studded with stars. To their right, a slope led to a partially frozen river. To their left, scattered snowdrifts. The locomotive was chugging up a slight grade, moving well below its average speed, but still much faster than Tucker would have liked. He tugged the collar of his jacket up around his neck against the frigid night. At his knee, Kane wagged his tail, excited. No surprise there. The shepherd was ready to go, come what may. Tucker knelt and cupped Kane's head in both of his hands, bringing his face down close. "Who's a good boy?" Kane leaned forward until their noses touched. "That's right. You are." It was a routine of theirs. Standing, but keeping a grip on Kane's vest collar, Tucker navigated the catwalk steps until they were only a few feet above the racing ground. He poked his head past the caboose's side, looking forward, waiting, watching, until he saw a particularly thick snowdrift approaching. "Ready, boy?" he said. "We're gonna jump. Steady now."
"Steady."
The snowdrift flashed into view. Tucker tossed his rucksack out into the darkness.
"Go, Kane. Jump!"
Without hesitation, the shepherd leaped out into the night. Tucker waited a beat, then followed.